We've been looking at the subject of the church for a few months now, and we began by seeing that the Greek word that is translated in most Bibles as church is the Greek word ekklesia, which means assembly or congregation. It literally means those who are called out. It was used of political gatherings in Athens, for example, when they said, right, let's vote on this issue, and they called them out into the public forum where they had their discussions. That was the assembly of people, and that word is used in the scriptures, and it's translated in most Bibles as church. Unfortunately, the English word church does not derive from ecclesia, it derives from a different Greek word, kuriakos, which means of the Lord. And as a result of hundreds of years of tradition and misuse, the word has come to be applied to buildings and to denominations. But the scriptures never use the word in that way. And so we've been trying to find out how the word is used in the scriptures and to discover who are the members of the church and how people should function within the church. We've looked at a variety of things. We've seen that the church is composed of believers and believers only, that it is necessary for people to be repentant and have faith in the Lord Jesus Christ in order to be a member of a church. We have seen various things along the way, including the importance of church discipline. And I promised some time ago that we would deal with the issue of the role of women within the church. And so that's what, God willing, we're going to do tonight. Now, we have a problem when we seek to deal with the role of women, and that problem is the modern culture in which we live. We have seen over the last, well, it's nearly 40 years now, the rise of feminism. And feminism seeks to argue that really there is not a lot of difference between men and women. Really, men and women are the same, and therefore women should be allowed to do everything that men can do because they're just as good. And so we now have what was thought impossible during the Second World War, and that is women on the front line in the army, in the navy, and the air force. Women are, it is said, can do the job just as good as men can in so many different areas of life. But if this were the case, then I'm sure that they would be arguing that men should be allowed to have children. And I mean, literally, they should be able to give birth. That's not happened yet. There was a program on the television last week which said, and here we have the first man giving birth. But it wasn't a man, it was a woman who had had a supposed sex change, so that she had the appearance of a man, but she was still a woman, as was proved by the fact that she could conceive and give birth to a child. We also see that it is acknowledged that there are differences between men and women, because no one has yet argued that they should abolish the men's singles competition and the women's singles competition at Wimbledon or any other tennis tournament and just have a singles tournament where the men play against the women. Because suddenly they would decide this isn't fair, all the women are getting knocked out in the first or second round. Because they have to acknowledge that men and women physically are different. But we do have from the world around us a pressure to conform to the world's way of thinking. The world's ideas about men and women, the world's ideas of justice, and these very often do not conform to the teaching of the scriptures. But it also has to be acknowledged that down through the centuries, various traditions have arisen that are not necessarily the teaching of the scriptures. What we must seek to do in all things, and not just in considering the role of women, is to discover what the scriptures teach. Now, feminists would say, oh, well, if you're going from the Bible, then you're going to say that the women should stay at home and do the cooking and wash the floors and not be allowed to do anything else, that really they should was going to say yes men, but that would not be appropriate, for their husbands and just do whatever their husbands tell them. That really, it's a surprise that those who believe the Bible don't insist that their wives walk 10 paces behind them or even have them on a lead to show that they are living in submission and subservience to their husbands. This, of course, is a caricature, and we need to look and see what the scriptures say. We also have a situation where there are many denominations around the world who ordain women. Some have been doing it for longer than others. If you read the history of, for example, the primitive Methodists who arose in the early part of the 19th century, they had women ministers from a fairly early date. And also within Congregationalism, there have been women ministers for some considerable time. I heard late last year a former professor of theology talking to someone about Congregationalism, and he said that it was the Congregationalists who were the first to ordain women ministers, and I bit my tongue and thought, well, I won't mention to him about the primitive Methodists, and we could go back even into the 16th century and talk about the Anabaptists, because while there were good Anabaptists, there were also bad Anabaptists, and some of the lunatic fringe of the Anabaptists believed and practiced all sorts of weird and wonderful things. But what we are going to seek to do tonight, and it's going to be brief because we could spend hours or even days on it, is to dig into the scriptures and see what the scriptures teach. So we will begin at the beginning. So if you turn to Genesis chapter 1, and we will read about the creation of man and woman. And in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26, we read, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. So at the beginning, in the image of God, man created man and woman. So women, as much as men, are created in the image and in the likeness of God. In chapter 2 of Genesis, we have, if you like, a zoom lens on that verse in Genesis chapter 1, and we have greater detail given to us. And if we look at verse 18, Adam has been created out of the dust of the ground. All the other animals in the garden, this isn't talking about all the other animals in the world, it's talking about the other animals in the garden, they were brought to him, and Adam noticed that they came along, male and female, they came along as couples, and Adam noticed that none of them were like him. And he realized that there was none like him, he needed a partner. And so God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make a helper fit for him." So out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field. He gave names, and it's verse 21. "So the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, this at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman." Not woe man, woman, because she was taken out of man. And I mentioned this morning about the nonsense that you hear from people saying, well, men have the same number of ribs as women, and so therefore this can't be true. It just shows an ignorance of biology and genetics. But I would like to direct you to Matthew Henry's comment on this verse. Now, this isn't an exact quote, but you might like to look it up. Many people think Matthew Henry wasn't here Puritan, so therefore if he's a Puritan, he's going to be harsh, cruel, unpleasant, women should be downtrodden. That's what Matthew Henry says about this. God took not from Adam's head to create Eve, so that she could rule over him. Neither did he make her from his feet, so that she would be trampled under his feet. But rather he took a rib from under his arm, close to his heart, that she might be cherished and cared for. So much for the Puritans being harsh and cruel and unpleasant and all the other things that are thrown at them. I might be wrong on some things, but the caricature that is given to us of the Puritans is so often completely wrong. So they were made, Adam and Eve, to complement each other. They are not the same, they are different. Anyone who insists that men and women are the same really needs to get their eyes tested. They are different. But then we get into chapter 3 of Genesis and something happens. Something rather sad happens. God has said to Adam that he shall not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He can eat from every other tree except that one tree. Now God says this to Adam. It appears he didn't say it to Eve. Eve learned this from Adam. Now that's a bit of conjecture, but I think that is the case, because when the serpent comes along at the beginning of chapter 3, he said to the woman, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat from any tree in the garden'?" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, neither shall you touch it.'" That's not what God said. Where did she get that from? And I can only guess, please note it's a guess, I can only guess that Adam said to her, "Don't eat it, and so therefore to be on the safe side, don't touch it either." So the devil tempts her, persuades her that really there's nothing wrong with eating the fruit, and so she eats, and then she gives some of the fruit to her husband, and he eats. And again, another common error, it is not an apple. Nowhere in this passage does it say that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was an apple tree. But it's a common myth that they ate an apple. It says nothing of the sort. But then, having eaten, they realize that they're naked. They hide from God. They seek to cover up their nakedness. And when God comes along and finds them, it's obvious. They can't hide the fact that they have disobeyed him. And in disobeying him, they will not take responsibility for themselves. Verse 12, when he's confronted with his sin, the man said, "It wasn't me, the woman whom you gave to be with me. She gave me the fruit of the tree and I ate. Not my fault, it's her fault, and it's your fault, God." So he refuses to take responsibility. God turns to the woman. "What is this that you have done?" The woman said, "It wasn't me, it's not my fault. The serpent deceived me, it's his fault." So then God pronounces judgment upon the serpent in verse 14 and 15. And we have the hint of the promise of the coming of Christ in verse 15. And then to the woman he says, "I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." So, labour pains, and I'm very glad that I'm not a woman because I've never had to suffer labour pains, but labour pains and the rule of men over women, or the husband over the wife, derives from the curse put upon the woman as a consequence of sin coming into the world. This is the situation we are now in. This is not the way God designed men and women this is how things have become because of sin. Now, there are lots of examples of godly women throughout the Old Testament, and you'll perhaps be familiar with the wonderful example that's given to us in Proverbs chapter 31, but we're concentrating on the role of women in the church. And really, the issue is, what degree of authority can a woman have within a church, and can a woman teach? Can she be an elder? Can she have that kind of authority? And so we leap over now into the New Testament, and before we get into the nitty-gritty, I want to take you via Romans chapter 16. Romans chapter 16, Paul, now having virtually finished the letter, sends greetings to a variety of people who are known to him in Rome. And it includes a not insignificant number of women. Indeed, right at the beginning of the chapter, he says, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a servant, the word in Greek is deacon, of the church at Cenchreae, that you may welcome her in the Lord in a way that is worthy of the saints. This woman carried this letter from Paul to the church in Rome. One of the most important letters, perhaps the most important letter, in the whole of the New Testament, Paul, who is often castigated as being a misogynist, misogynist is someone who hates women, Paul entrusted this most important letter to a woman. Paul obviously had a very high view of this woman to entrust her with such a letter. In verse 3, greet Prisca and Aquila. That's Priscilla and Aquila, and we read about in Acts. And we'll get to them eventually on a Sunday morning and read about the sort of things that they were doing. And there's a number of others who are listed there. Paul had a high regard for women. And yet people describe him falsely as a misogynist. So women were heavily involved in the early church. But there is something that is true of most women in New Testament times, which is that most of them, just as today, would get married. And in New Testament times, it would be almost inevitable that they would have children. We today can choose whether to have children or not, and we can choose, with a fair degree of reliability, how many we have. Such a choice was not available to people in the first century. And so if you read, for example, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, you find that Paul is saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone was like me, that is, a single missionary, who can go around spreading the gospel without having to worry about your husband or your wife, and you can just concentrate on the things of God. As soon as you get married, you're worried about your husband or your wife and your children, which can be a problem. If you start to suffer persecution, then the persecutors can say, if you don't renounce the faith, then we will kill your husband, your wife, your children. And you're torn. But they can't carry out such a threat if you're not married and if you don't have children. Also, we'll just note in passing, at the beginning of the chapter, Paul speaks about the relationship of a husband to a wife, and in verse 4, he says, the wife does not have authority over her own body. See, people say, Paul says that a woman is the slave of a man. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Unfortunately, people who love to quote from that and say, see how dreadful the Bible is against women, don't carry on reading. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. A husband and a wife, when they marry, they give themselves to each other. And there is this lovely union between a man and a woman that you don't get outside of marriage, where each one gives themselves to the other for the benefit of the other. And sadly, many modern marriages, because they ignore this, they're only concerned about satisfying me, but they never really enjoy what God has designed for marriage. But let's move on and consider more specifically the case of what is the situation within churches. We've been talking more generally, now let's get down to a bit more of the nitty-gritty. Some people love to quote from 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 14. And 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 33. We read, as in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silent in churches. They are not permitted to speak, but should be in submission, as the law also says. If there is anything they desire to learn, let them ask their husbands at home. For it is shameful for a woman to speak in church. And there you are. If any of the women think that I'm spouting heresy tonight, you're not allowed to say so. Got to keep silent. It says so in the scriptures. And consequently, you get the modern feminists that say, see what Paul thought of women. What a dreadful thing. And then they would also turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 2, where we read in verse 11, let a woman learn in silence, say some translations. This one says, let a woman learn quietly, with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. See, women, well, perhaps it's a good idea if we could somehow zip up their lips, and then we won't have them prattling away and telling the men what they should be doing. And so people say, see, the case is clear. Paul had a downer on women. He wanted to shut them up. Really, he hated them. He wanted them to keep their place and just do as they were told. Is that in fact the case? In 1 Timothy 2, Paul then gives his reason. So often, people read to the end of verse 12 and stop. And they say, well, of course, such a thing was all because of the culture of the time. And we now live in a different culture, so that no longer applies to us. But if only they read on, they would see that Paul gives his reasons. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. So, man has a priority over the woman, but also, Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. When Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, she didn't understand what she was doing. She was deceived. But when she said to Adam, come on, try some of this, he knew exactly what he was doing. He understood. And there is something about the difference between men and women. Women are more trusting. Women are more open to accept things. Now, this is not, you can't say this of every single one, because there will always be exceptions. And people always love to bring up the exceptions. we're talking generally, women are more trusting and accepting, men are more hard-nosed, and they don't work on the basis of what we might call gut instinct. And so because of this, Paul says that this reason, that's why women are not allowed to teach or to have authority over men. We go back to 1 Corinthians. At the beginning of chapter 11, you might want to have a finger in verse 14, chapter 14 as well, but at the beginning of 1 Corinthians 11, we read about prophecy. I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions, even as I deliver them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is the same as if she was shaven. And so it's clear that you have the situation in the New Testament where women prophesy. Indeed, if you look at Acts chapter 21, you'll read about Philip. Philip the evangelist, who was one of the first deacons, he had four daughters who were prophetesses. So it is clear that there were instances in the New Testament of women who prophesied. Now we'll just take a little aside for a moment and to remind you of what 1 Corinthians 11 is about. People say that this is talking about women wearing hats or wearing headscarves or something like that. It's very simple if you read what it actually says and not what it doesn't say. It talks here about a woman having a covering upon her head. A woman should have a covering, a woman should have a covering, a woman should have a covering, a woman should have a covering. The end of verse 16, for her hair is given to her for a covering. The covering that is being spoken of by Paul this chapter is not a hat, it is not a veil, it is not a headscarf, it is a hair. So if you ever go to a brethren assembly and they complain because you're not wearing a hat, say, I'm sorry, but the Bible doesn't require me to do that. The Bible requires me to have hair on my head, and as you can see, I've got some, unless you happen to suffer from alopecia, which means you have no hair at all, because you have this condition whereby you can't grow hair. You're completely bald all over, but you might wear a wig just so that people don't stare at you. It's hair is what Paul's talking about. But back in 1 Corinthians 14, remembering that women can prophesy, we find in 1 Corinthians Paul is talking about how to respond to prophecy. Verse 26. What then, brothers? When you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, that's a prophecy, a tongue or an interpretation of tongues. Let all things be done for building up. If anyone speak in a tongue, let there be only two or at most three, and each in turn. And let someone interpret. But if there is no one to interpret, let each of them keep silent in church, and speak to himself and to God. Let two or three prophets speak. It's interesting, you go to some charismatic meetings, and there's people all over the place babbling away in tongues, and jumping up and down and giving what they call prophecies, totally violating what Paul says here. It's not two or three, it's chaos. Let two or three prophets speak, and let the others weigh what is said. If a revelation is made to another sitting there, let the first be silent. But you can all prophesy one by one, so that all may learn and all be encouraged. And the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets, for God is not a God of confusion, but of peace. He's talking about how we respond to revelations of God's truth via tongues, which should be interpreted, and this becomes prophecy, or by direct prophecy. How do we respond to this when it is given and we have no more than three? when it is given, it should be evaluated, it should be weighed. The people present should discuss, is this in fact the truth of God, and if it is, how should we apply it? And then Paul says, as in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silent in churches. They should keep silent in churches in the context of weighing up the value of prophecy. I don't think Paul is saying here, and I'm very glad to discover that there are other people who have written on this and agree with me, or perhaps I should say I agree with them, this is not a blanket ban on a woman ever opening her mouth in the context of a church meeting. I think it is in the context of prophecy. A woman can prophesy, so therefore she can speak in a meeting, if she can prophesy, but she is not allowed to weigh up and evaluate whether or not it is a valid revelation from God and how it should apply, because then it comes under the realm of teaching, and women are not allowed to teach or have authority over men. So if you ever come across anyone who says, well, women should keep silent in church and never say a word, I don't think that's what the passage is actually saying. It's talking about prophecy. And we don't have prophecy today. That ended in the first century. And so therefore, that ban does not apply. Although I think there are some husbands who have the experience of sitting in a meeting and the preacher is preaching and his wife will lean over to him and say, what does he mean by that? I think it's a very good idea then for the wife to just wait and learn later. Ask questions afterwards. If necessary, write down the questions you've got and then ask later. And it's perhaps better to ask the preacher, because you can't guarantee that the husband is going to understand what on earth the preacher's talking about. Preachers aren't always perfect communicators. So, what else do we learn from the scriptures about how women should behave? Women are not to be teachers of men, but they are to be teachers of other women, the older women of the younger women, in Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2. But as for you, Titus, teach what accords with sound doctrine. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good, and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. Likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. And then we have also in 2 Timothy chapter 1. I am reminded of your sincere faith, speaking to Timothy, a faith that dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and now, I am sure, dwells in you as well, the implication being that Timothy learnt the gospel from his mother and from his grandmother. They taught him as a child. And so there are grounds for women to teach children and to teach other women, having received teaching from the men. Now, some people argue that the only role that a woman should have is that of bearing and raising children, and virtually nothing else. Well, while it is good that women bear, it is a very good thing that women bear and raise children, otherwise, of course, none of us would be here. But they are allowed to do other things. You do get the other extreme, of course, where feminists almost despise women that have children and look after their families. What's wrong with a woman, if she chooses, getting married, having children, and looking after her family? And yet so many modern feminists despise people that do that. I think such people are to be commended. And if a woman decides not to marry and decides to go off and be a missionary and to do all sorts of other things, that's equally commendable. But we're not to force people into a mould that is not of a biblical basis. We are to get people to see what the scriptures teach and follow what the scriptures teach. So does this mean that women can carry out functions within the church? Well, if they're capable, certainly. There's no problem, as far as I can see, in a woman being a deacon. You might want to call them a deaconess. I see no problem in that. I don't think that violates any scripture at all. Because it doesn't involve teaching. As we saw when we looked at elders and deacons, it is a problem in some churches, because in some churches, the deacons, some of them really are elders. And then you get a problem with having women as deacons. But if you have deacons as deacons according to the scriptures, not a problem. You have elders as elders, the elders, as we've seen, being men only. Let me just refer you to one other passage that is often abused, and that is in 1 Peter chapter 3. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, this is particularly referring to unbelieving husbands, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Do not let your adornment be external, the braiding of hair, the wearing of gold, or the putting on of clothing. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, and the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you are her children, if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. And people read that passage and they say, ah, right, so, women should wear the plainest possible clothing, sacks if possible, they should never wear rings, they should never wear earrings, they should never have bangles on their wrists, they should never have any kind of decoration at all, whatsoever. And again, it's a question of what does the passage actually say, and what does it not say? Because to follow the logic of what these people would insist upon, well, women shouldn't even wear sacks. Because if this is to be taken strictly and straightforwardly, do not let your adornment be external, the braiding of hair, the wearing of gold, or the putting on of clothing. So to follow the logic of some people, women should not wear any clothes at all. That's absurd. That's not what Peter's saying. What Peter's saying is, the important thing is your character that should show through. People should see the godliness of your life. Now, if you adorn yourself in such a way that you have the latest punk hairstyle and you have rainbow colours in your hair, if you're wearing some of the fashions that you see on the fashion catwalks, and you think, good grief, how on earth can they wear that sort of thing, then you're trying to draw attention to yourself, not by who you are, but by what you're wearing. And what you're wearing becomes more important than who you are. Women in the scriptures are allowed to wear what they are happy with, what they are comfortable with, perhaps even what their husbands like them to wear. But it doesn't mean that you can't plait your hair. Because isn't plaiting hair a braiding of hair? I don't see that there's any prohibition on doing, having your hair done at all. I think the prohibition is upon saying, look at me and my wonderful hair. Look at me and see all this flashy gold that I've got. Look at me and see the latest fashion that I'm wearing. Perhaps some people need to do that because their characters are rather dire and unpleasant, and the only way they can attract anybody is by being flashy. Better to be godly. Better to allow godliness to show out through your life and not allow people to be distracted from what you're really like inside. Because it's what's inside that people should really be interested in. If they're only interested in the externals, then they're just as shallow as you are. So women have an important place and role within the Church of God. They are restricted in what they're allowed to do because they are not allowed to teach or to have authority over men. But apart from that, they can function very well within churches and they can carry out a variety of responsibilities within churches, and we should encourage them so to do. Men and women are different. God has designed us differently, although both in the image of God. We should take into account what the scriptures say and what is obvious about the differences between men and women. Men are to be the heads of households, and the leaders and teachers of churches. And men are responsible, so husbands are responsible, to love their wives as their own bodies and be prepared to die for their wives, just as Christ died for the church. The traditional role that women have had within society, while there may be some objections to it from a biblical point of view, our objection should be based on what the scriptures teach and not on what the world teaches. Here is a subject where it is important we come back all the time to see what the scriptures say and to follow the scriptures and not to follow the world. Now, I suspect there are things that I've said that may have raised hackles or not, and you might want to come back at me on some of those. So has anybody got any questions?